From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on the Forum program this morning, in the hour ahead, breeding mosquitoes resistant to the malaria virus and designing human babies free of genetic disorders. Those are just a couple of the goals that might be possible in the near future, thanks to gene editing technology like CRISPR. UC Berkeley professor Jennifer Doudna, one of the first pioneers of CRISPR, will join us to discuss the possibilities and the significance. Forum is next. Join us. It's after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to a second hour of this morning's Forum program. Will genetic editing reshape our world? Well, UC Berkeley professor Jennifer Doudna published a landmark paper 2 years ago on a strategy to target and cut out DNA from multiple cells of microbes, plants, and animals, a process known as CRISPR. And just last year, she and her colleagues showed that this molecular scissors approach can be used to disable or add several genes at once in human cells, offering a potential new tool to treat complex genetic diseases. Jennifer Doudna and her partner were named by Time Magazine to the annual 100 Most Influential People in the World list, and she is executive director of the UC Berkeley UCSF Innovative Genomics Institute and a recipient of the Lurie Prize in Biomedical Sciences awarded by the NIH. And we welcome Jennifer Doudna to this second hour forum. Delighted to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, let's begin by talking right about CRISPR-Cas9, which makes it cheap and easy and fast to actually move genes around, any genes in any living organism. I mean, this is Brave New World in many respects, but it's also something you called a triumph of basic science.
Indeed. I think that's one of the fun things about this story is that it is a project that began with a curiosity-driven project with myself and my collaborators and led to a technology that none of us anticipated at the get-go.
And this technology has now, we'll find out more about it, but it's something that you never would have predicted. You've got over 100 labs now doing this kind of genomics engineering, and it's become almost a kind of frenzy in many ways.
Yeah, it's really amazing the way the technology has taken off over the last several years, and we're seeing a lot of interesting applications, lots of enthusiasm about the potential for curing disease, among other things.
And many other things which we'll talk about, but let's talk first about gene editing techniques, what CRISPR-Cas9 is. It's an acronym, CRISPR, for clustered, regularly interspaced, I guess, short palindromic reports, being like palindromes because the gene sequences are both the same backward and forward, essentially.
That's right.
And so this is a genetic basis for a method which includes, well, a protein or an enzyme added to it, and then you're in business, so to speak.
Indeed. It's a way that bacteria fight viral infection. They store bits of viral DNA in the CRISPR sequences in their own genome and then use that information to protect the cell from future viral infection.
And there's been certainly a lot of concern about, well, let's talk first about what this actually can do and then maybe go into the hype of what many people believe it's going to be doing. But first, talk a little bit more about, if you would, how this works. Because RNA is involved in this too, and we can get into the weeds here as soon as we're talking about DNA and RNA. But you found that CRISPR essentially makes a couple of short RNA strands when the enzyme Cas9 is attached to it?
Well, yeah. So let's take a step back. The cell, we're talking about bacteria. They store bits of viral DNA in their own genome and their own genetic material. And then the bacterial cell makes a little copy of that viral DNA in the form of a chemical cousin of DNA called RNA. And these RNA bits then will come together with a protein called Cas9 that's also part of this bacterial immune system. And together, the protein and RNA can search through the cell looking for DNA sequences that match the sequence in the RNA. And if they find a site that has that match, then the Cas9 protein will make a very precise break in the DNA double helix.
And we've had some real successes with this. I guess there was a cancer case in London. Can you talk about that? Or with an infant?
Yeah, you're talking about this patient that had leukemia, where it was possible to use gene editing to actually provide a cure for that child. It wasn't, in that case, it wasn't using the CRISPR technology. It was using an earlier technology for gene editing. But I think it really shows the direction that this research is going.
But CRISPR also is talking about the possibility of eliminating the pathogens that mosquitoes carry. So we would technically, I suppose, eliminate malaria and maybe eliminate Zika and all these other things that mosquitoes carry.
Yeah, kind of an amazing thought. Yeah.
I mean, but it's amazing, and yet it's right within the realm of possibility, which is what I'm so struck by. And
right.
There are so many potential possibilities for this. I almost said consequences, because there are also consequences to be concerned about. But, you know, people are talking about changes, industrial, world population being fed. Of course, then you have GMOs, I suppose, as a problem. But talk about just the possibilities here, aside from all the hype we get. There are real clinical and treatment possibilities.
Right. So I guess I would start by saying that I think one of the things that's so interesting about this technology is that it operates in essentially any type of cell that's been tested. That means that it works in human cells, but it also works in other kinds of animal cells, in plant cells, fungi, and virtually any other organism where it's been introduced. So it makes it a very cross-cutting technology. And all of the things that you just mentioned, so doing things like, you know, thinking about treating a cancer patient or eliminating a vector for disease like mosquitoes, I think, you know, these are all things that are within the realm of possibility now. And so we have to really start thinking about how do we use this technology responsibly.
Indeed. And that brings us right back to, in my memory, 1975, when a convening of the recombinant DNA went on close to home here. And actually, that was at Acelamar. David Baltimore kind of leading the way, as I recall. And all this concern about what cloning could do and what messing around with genes could do in general. This is a little bit of deja vu all over again. You convened something in Napa that tried to get to some kind of consensus.
Yeah, this was convened last January by the Innovative Genomics Initiative, a UC Berkeley UCSF partnership. We convened a meeting in the Napa Valley to discuss exactly these kinds of issues. And interestingly, we invited David Baltimore as well as Paul Berg, two of the scientists who were involved in the 1975 meeting at Acelamar, to talk about molecular cloning.
And what came out of that?
That was a fascinating meeting. It was a small group of people. We included a couple of prominent bioethicists, lawyers, Hank Greeley at Stanford and Alta Charo from Wisconsin, who have been deeply involved in the legalities around and sort of bioethics around technologies that have come along over the years. And the outcome of that was publication of a perspective that appeared in Science magazine last March, in which we proposed what we called a prudent path forward for application of the CRISPR technology, or really any genome editing technology, especially when we think about applying it in humans for creating changes in the DNA that would become inherited. And we basically proposed that the community refrain from doing that kind of clinical use of CRISPR technology to give time for society to discuss the ethical and other implications of that use.
You mentioned Hank Greeley, who's, of course, been on the show a number of times. And
right.
We ought to add the fact that he and Alto Charo co-wrote a paper about non-human implications of CRISPR. But CRISPR, people are saying, you know, can lead to elimination of disease, can solve, as I said, world hunger. I mean, you know, you have to separate, I suppose, the hype from the possibilities, but the possibilities are there. Even somebody talking about unicorns, you know, going back and reconfiguring genes in that way, the way they were talking about woolly mammoths and the like. But some serious ethical questions and safety questions. And when actually you convened that meeting up in Napa, I believe there were people who were saying, well, they left out the disabled population. They should have included the disabled population or people with disabilities. There was also some concerns that there was no regulatory framework in many nations, and those nations were not included. This all has to be seen in the big picture.
Okay, but I think we're conflating a couple things here. So the meeting in the Napa Valley was a very small group, you know, less than 20 people. But the important thing there is that it triggered not only this publication that I mentioned, but then the the national academies in China, the United States, and the United Kingdom got together and organized an international summit on human germline, sort of human, you know, embryo editing that was held in December of this past year. So just
China was editing human embryos. That was what started that.
Well, there's already one publication on that. So, you know, so you're right that, you know, does this mean that, you know, that we can control what people around the world are doing? It doesn't. But it means that I think it's really great that the scientific community internationally is coming together to discuss these topics. There are future meetings planned. I know that there's a number of things going on both in Asia and Europe now to discuss these matters more locally and to involve additional constituencies like the disabled population, as well as you know, people that have face other kinds of genetic disease challenges in their families.
And the National Academy of Sciences has been involved in trying to set up guidelines and recommendations. Yeah,
indeed.
Jennifer Doudna here with us in studio. And by the way, she is professor of chemistry and molecular and cell biology at UC Berkeley, executive director of the Innovative Genomics Initiative, and also an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and helped develop a technology for editing genomes called CRISPR-Cas9, or CRISPR for short. Can you give us a general sense of the battles that are going on over patents? I mean, this has been some original research for you, but there are others. We mentioned China. There's Feng Sheng, who's Chinese-American. He's at MIT. There's a lot of battling going on, and involves not only universities, but really, frankly, billions of dollars.
You know, I think anytime there's a new technology, there are multiple claims around it. And we're seeing that here with the CRISPR technology. What's fascinating to me is that the science is so exciting that, the patent issues are really not slowing anybody down, whether they're in academic groups or commercial groups. And we're seeing a really incredible pace of science. Just, I think this technology is enabling experiments that could have really not been anticipated or really certainly carried out even a few years ago. So that's what's so fascinating to me, is that it's just the pace has not slowed down. The patent issues will, you know, probably take a while to resolve. But in the meantime, great science is going on.
Patent issues should include a lot of money at stake.
Potentially, yes.
From what I'm reading, not even potentially. At this point, we could be talking about many billions of dollars, especially where all this research is going to go. And where is it going to go? A New Yorker had an article. They said, you're closing in on a grand unified theory of genetics. And you mentioned Hank Greeley before. He said, this is the Model T of, the Model T of genetics.
I think that one of the things that makes this technology fascinating is that it comes at a time when there are so many other both technical and fundamental breakthroughs that are happening in biology. So, for example, we now have technologies that enable rapid and inexpensive sequencing of the entire human genome. So that means that we can have the entire letter code of somebody's genetic material for, you know, around $1,000 now. And so I think, you know, we're approaching a time when many people, at least initially in the developed world, will have that information essentially at their fingertips. And then the question is, what do you do with it? So if you see something in that code that is potentially going to provide problems or give rise to disease phenotypes in the future, we now have a technology that could, in principle, make a correction that would really affect and cure a disease. I think that's what people are excited about.
Well, there's also a lot of excitement about the possibility of correcting genetic flaws in the embryos, because that's plausible, too, in this whole picture.
It certainly is plausible.
And there's just so many things that are plausible and that may be happening. Talk about what your apprehensions are, though. You know, what is maybe because there are always unintended and unexpected and unpredictable consequences. But what's the darker side of this now, as you see it?
Well, I think a couple things come to mind. I think that whenever a technology comes along and, you know, people get very excited about it, it can be the case that people's excitement kind of gets ahead of the science. And I'd like to see that not happen here. So case in point is, you know, I think that this idea of using it as a way to cure genetic disease in embryos is tantalizing. But I think that we need to ensure that we both understand, you know, the technology and its safety and efficacy, as well as really grapple with the ethical implications of that before proceeding clinically for that kind of use. And another area which you brought up earlier, which I think also raises various ethical questions, certainly safety issues potentially, is using this in organisms that would be released in the environment. So some people think it might be a great idea to use it to drive genes through a population of, say, mosquitoes, such that you create animals that are infertile and then lead ultimately to the destruction of that species. Sounds great to get rid of mosquitoes, maybe, but I think we do need to think about potentially, you know, the unintended consequences.
Somebody say get rid of mosquitoes, bats feed off mosquitoes. I mean, it's always...
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's an ecosystem, right?
It is indeed the ecosystem. And I'm also interested in what you have to say about the fact that we are at a different stage now with CRISPR and all this research you're doing. I mean, we're beyond mice, really, in fact, and fruit flies. We're moving into a different phase.
Well, you bring up a very interesting point that I think hasn't been emphasized maybe as much as it should be based on what's happening scientifically. And that is that this technology, because it operates in many different types of organisms and cells, it really opens up genetics and genetic research in organisms that in the past have been intractable to scientists. And so it means that rather than having to rely on just a few what we call model organisms to understand the basis for life and disease, we can now study these pathways in essentially any type of organism using a technology that enables manipulation of their DNA.
Let's talk also about agriculture, because you've already seen some. There's wheat now that's essentially can't be affected by fungi that once affected it. I mean, we're moving forward on that plane to a great degree, aren't we?
That's absolutely right. And I think, you know, this is a wonderful technology for plant biology. It really opens up the path towards understanding the fundamental genetics of plants, as well as providing chances for what you just said, you know, protecting plants against pathogens that would attack them, helping them to adapt to changing climate conditions, those sorts of things.
You can make crops immune to blight, theoretically, right?
In theory, yes.
And unicorns?
I guess we'll find out. I don't know.
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, just all these things that have come up, as I said, in the process. I'm going to actually open up our phone lines and find out what listeners think about all this brave new world, as I call it. But also, any questions you might have about the research Jennifer Doudna is doing and your response to it. We're talking really about a brave new world in a really affirmative sense. I mean, especially if it can help people with treatment and feed the messing starved people in the world and all of that, but at the same time, the possibility of unintended or unpredictable or even, as I've put it, darker consequences. Let's hear what you have to say, and let's have you join the conversation. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your call, so feel free to join the program. Again, toll-free, you can do that now, 866-733-6786. And a number of other ways you can join the program with any questions or comments you might have. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and we do welcome your calls and emails, so please feel free to join us. And can you talk, Jennifer, a little bit about, Professor Doudna? You prefer?
Please call me Jennifer.
Actually, I was mentioning to Jennifer before we went on the air, one of my closest friends is a plant biologist, and he's very high on her research, and he thinks you're a shoo-in for a Nobel. We won't even necessarily go there, but he was saying to me, she's like us. And I said, what do you mean she's like us? And he said, well, you know, we went to this state school, Ohio University. She went to the University of Hawaii, you know, doesn't have one of these fancy Ivy League pedigrees or whatever and so forth and so on. And plus, from everything he heard about you, you're just sort of regular gal. Or what did they say? Used to call you dude?
I've been called the dude, absolutely.
The dude, because of your last name, yeah.
And slight correction. So I actually never attended the University of Hawaii to get a degree. I took some courses there, but I grew up in a small town in Hawaii. I went to public high school, and certainly nobody in my family was a scientist. So I'm sort of homegrown in that sense.
What got you interested in scientists and science in the first place? What drew you to it?
I I think a couple of things. You know, I remember my dad throwing a copy of The Double Helix written by James Watson on my bed when I was probably in sixth grade.
And Francis Crick.
Having a look at that book and just being stunned at scientists being able to do experiments to discover the structure of a molecule.
It seemed
incredible.
How old were you?
I was probably 12 or 13, something
like
that.
If you're reading The Double Helix at 12 or 13.
Well, I don't know if I read it cover to cover, but I read enough of it to know that it was pretty cool, you know, science. And the other thing I think, you know, when I think back on it is just the unique environment of Hawaii, just coming across organisms that had evolved in that island environment to have unique properties. And I always wondered why. What's the molecular basis for that?
Boy, it was a big question. I was in Hana not that long ago, and I was thinking along those same lines. I mean, you see these things that are just indigenous to only Hana, you know, and you go.
Right.
It was fascinating. We're going to go to our calls and emails here, but I just want to find out more about this innovative coalition between UCSF and UC Berkeley called the Innovative Genomics Institute. What are you studying?
Yeah, let me tell you just briefly about that. It's a great partnership between, you know, a fundamental research university and the great medical school that UCSF is. And we have a team of scientists who are essentially bringing together people like me that do research on fundamental systems in biology and connecting them with clinical medical doctors and patients. Ultimately, we really are excited about bringing this technology to help patients and doing that in an academic setting, as well as inviting companies to partner with us to do that. And I want to point out, we were funded initially by a generous gift from the Li Ka-shing Foundation in Hong Kong, and we now have additional donors.
Oh, good luck to you. I knew I'd get questions like this. I'm looking at Rick, who says, I wonder what your guest thinks about the likely next step after gene repair, which could be the design of a super species or gene improvement. One could imagine the banning of less worthy genes, probably to all the risk of us all.
Fascinating question. I think, you know, what I would say right now is that what prevents that from happening is our limited knowledge of the human genome, quite frankly. We wouldn't know what genes to alter to make a super species today.
We're going to know a lot more soon enough, though, aren't we?
We will. I mean, it's, you know, knowledge is expanding, as you know.
We mentioned James Watson. I remember asking him directly when he was pretty much in charge, you know, where's this human genome going to take us? And he says, we don't know, but it's going to take us probably everywhere and anywhere that we even imagine. And we will take you along with us in this discussion we're having with Jennifer Doudna. Again, she's professor of chemistry and molecular and cell biology at UC Berkeley and executive director of the Innovative Genomic Initiative, also an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. And she helped develop this technology that we're talking about for editing genomes called CRISPR-Cas9, or simply for short, CRISPR. When we return, we'll hear from you. Again, you can join us a number of ways, either by phone, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways you can become involved with the program, and we invite you to do so. You're listening to The Forum Program. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, UC Berkeley professor Jennifer Doudna with us in studio, one of the first pioneers of gene editing technology known as CRISPR, and we're talking about the future of gene editing, its potential impact on human and non-human life, everything from curing cancer to designer babies. She's professor of chemistry and molecular and cell biology at UC Berkeley and executive director of the Innovative Genomics Initiative. Let me go to your calls, and let me begin with Marcy Donofsky, who's calling us from Oakland. Morning, Marcy Donofsky.
Good morning. I work with the Center for Genetics and Society. We're a public interest organization based in Berkeley. And I wanted to get Jennifer Doudna's thoughts about this idea of designer babies beyond just that we don't know what genes to alter now. There have been scientists, including George Church at Harvard, who proposes altering genes for things we do know about, like needing less sleep or having stronger bones or a particular kind of fast twitch versus slow twitch muscles. So I think we're already at a point where it's conceivable that we could control the traits of future children and generations. And I think there's a couple important points to make. One is that we don't need this technique to prevent the transmission of inherited diseases because we have other ways to do that in almost every case. And the second point is that we could really be opening the door to pretty dire scenarios in the future where we would have new kinds of inequality based on genetic traits or what we think the genetics that we've changed can control. And we might find ourselves in a society of genetic haves and have-nots. And since we don't really need this technique for medical reasons, isn't that something we should avoid?
Well, thank you for the question, Marcy. And I'm actually looking at a dovetailing question from a listener named Kenny who says, what about the movie Gallica and discrimination against people who are – Gattaca, excuse me, and discrimination against people who are not enhanced? Bringing up that same question, Jennifer Doudna?
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think these are very interesting questions and you provide an interesting perspective. I think that's one point of view and other people view things differently. So this is, to me, exactly why we need to be discussing this issue very openly, inviting people from different walks of life to get involved in this conversation. You know, when you have a technology that comes along that enables new things to occur, whether it's editing babies or anything else that's, you know, going to affect our living situation here on Earth, we have to be really thinking together about how to use it responsibly. And I think that's the situation we find ourselves in now with this technology.
And Marcy, let me thank you for the call. You could, of course, again, this is all plausible. This is all at least within the realm of possibility, eliminate AIDS.
And, you know, there's a company in Richmond, California trying to do that, Sangamo Biosciences, that has a treatment using gene editing that's in clinical trials for that.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me get a caller on from Alameda. Mike, you're on. Morning.
Good morning. I'd hate to weigh in on the negative side of this, but I was wondering about the weaponization potential for this technology and both governmental and non-governmental groups using it.
Yeah, Jennifer Doudna.
Well, there was just a statement from the National Intelligence Agency that actually did classify the CRISPR technology as a WMD. I don't know if you saw that statement.
Saddam didn't have any of that.
Not to our knowledge. So, you know, I think
the potential is there, though.
But, the potential is there. And again, I feel that, you know, for any powerful technology, there's the possibility to use it for ill purpose. And this is why the society, societal discussion around this is so critical.
And let me thank the caller. I mean, it gets back to what I said in my introduction. It's in so many ways, this kind of technology and this DNA editing that we're talking about can literally reshape the world we're in.
Yeah.
Let's find out. Again, we're having this conversation. It's an important conversation, and you're welcome to join us. Toll free, it's 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Go to a Berkeley caller, and Sadie, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, I'm calling from Berkeley. I just wanted to ask if you could elaborate a little bit more on when you said that CRISPR is a triumph of basic science and what type of future investments we need to make in kind of these more esoteric scientific projects.
Wonderful question. I think it's such an important point to make here about this technology, which is that, you know, fundamentally in science, when we're doing science, when we're doing research, we're investigating the natural world, and we don't know what we're going to find, and we don't know where new technologies are going to come from. So I believe very strongly that it's essential that that we support fundamental research, that we enable scientists to follow their curiosity about the natural world, because we don't know where that curiosity will take them. And I think that, you know, the CRISPR technology is a great case in point for this. You know, that I came to this, I came to begin studying this system because of fundamental research that was being conducted in Jillian Banfield's lab at Berkeley. So she was one of the early labs finding the CRISPR sequences in bacterial DNA and wondering what they were doing. And it was through our, you know, curiosity-driven project to figure that out that we realized it could be harnessed as a technology. So, you know, to make that point, I think, you know, it's really critical that we ask our legislators and our funding agencies in this country to continue to support basic research so that we have the possibility of finding new things that we can't predict and can't anticipate.
Let me thank the caller. Actually, the real break for you was with that Swedish microbiologist you work with, Emmanuelle Charpentier.
That's right. I mean, it was really my collaboration with Emmanuelle and her laboratory in Europe that led to the understanding of the system that allowed us to harness it as a technology.
And back in 2011, you founded something called Caribou. What was that?
Yeah. So, you know, early on in our research on these CRISPR immune systems, it was pretty clear to us that there were a number of enzymes, meaning proteins and RNA molecules that operate in these pathways that could be useful as tools, as research tools. And so graduate student in my lab at the time, Rachel Harwitz, we founded Caribou Biosciences, and we brought in two other founders, James Berger and Martin Jinek. And that company is now operational in Berkeley and is a platform technology company. It's basically focusing on developing CRISPR molecules as research tools.
And talking about the wide swath of what can be done with CRISPR technology, there was also, I think, in Japan, this goes back to actually slow the ripening of tomatoes.
Amazing, right? I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, I think there's so many opportunities for controlling the way that genetic information is used in cells or changing it so that you can have desirable properties such as the one you mentioned.
Bob wants to know, is research based on CRISPR being conducted for life extension?
There's certainly a lot of interest in that, you know, both from companies as well as academic research laboratories. Yes.
So rest assured, there's research on that. and Elizabeth asks, as a scientist engineer, most doomsday fears of genetic engineering don't seem realistic to me. What risks do you think are real?
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. I think, you know, it's easy to get carried away with our sort of imaginations about how this might be employed. I think my biggest fear, honestly, when I think about applications in humans today, at least, is more that something would be done that would, you know, cause a public backlash against the technology and would, you know, that would be perceived to be either unethical or unsafe or both, and would cause the public to ask regulators to try to put a stop to research using this. And I think that would be very unfortunate.
Another question from a listener named Amelia. She wants to know, has Jennifer Doudna experienced any gender discrimination in her path toward becoming a well-known scientist?
Well, you know, this topic comes up a lot. And I have to say that, you know, earlier in my career, honestly, I just never gave it a thought. I didn't really think about my gender. I just, you know, I pursued my passion for science and research. But I do have to tell you that, you know, as I've gone on in my career and maybe really over the last, particularly the last 10 years or so, I've gotten, I guess, to a point in my career where I do now see signs of the glass ceiling. I don't think it's always intentional bias, but I do think there is, you know, I do experience bias against women in some settings, yes.
Advancing to what level? Where's that glass ceiling?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that it's very difficult for women to break into the top echelons of sort of leadership in science. And that's true both academically. I'm not talking so much here about, you know, university leadership, but more sort of leadership at the level of, you know, the highest levels of public policy in the government, as well as in company boardrooms.
Well, they can stand on your shoulders now as things continue. I mean, you've really made some major breakthroughs here. Let me go to more of our callers and go to Palo Alto. Scott, you're on.
Hey, thank you. I apologize if I'm not as articulate as I usually am, but I'm physically shaking a little here. And that's because having just watched a News Magazine piece documentary on the New Genetic Institute in China, where they showed the young fertility couples at the clinic waiting in lines, and then once they got released to go to the next part of the clinic to choose their baby's eye color, height, hair, etc., there was almost a low-grade stampede. this absolutely frightens me because I've had cancer many times over 25 years, and so much so that I'm having secondary cancers from my original treatments. And I live across the street from Stanford because I have to see 12 different specialists, even in remission, because of the side effects. So when the guest, your guest there, as articulate as she is, and I'm not, uses the words imagination and concern over that running amok, and also time for discussion, I think we're way past that when money gets involved with opportunity and individual behavior. So I was wondering if you guys could address that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Concern about, you know, when big money is involved, ethics maybe go out the window.
It's a concern, isn't it? I share your feelings about that. I saw that program, too, and I had the same. It gave me the shakes as well. You know, it's kind of freaky. I don't quite know how we, you know, how do we put a stop to that? I don't really know how one does that. I mean, you know, a particular country or jurisdiction can put regulations in place, but I don't really see a way to enforce that globally. So I think from my perspective, the best that I can do as a scientist and an individual is just to be involved in transparency and, you know, public discussion and education around this. I think we want to make sure that people understand that this is where we are today with this technology and, you know, to involve as many people in that conversation as possible.
Yeah, when I mentioned China before, they seem to be going in different directions that would not necessarily, shall we say, be as agreeable to National Academy of Sciences here and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's right. There are cultural differences.
It's like they're hacking into us. I mean, what can we? Well, let me go to more of our callers and raising some serious questions here. Obviously, Francis, join us. You're on the air.
Yes, I recently read an article where they're using a substance found in breast milk to create an antibiotic. And let's see, and nothing in the article talked at all about the potential danger. I think that's, if they're all of a sudden we start getting breast milk antibiotic, you know, bacteria resistant to breast milk spreading around, that could be extremely, you know, a threat, an existential threat to humanity. And I'm wondering, you know, is there any organization that, it seems like all the, Every talk I see in science journals and things about this, and never ever do I see something that talks about the potential dangers. And it seems like all you have to do is have one, you know, bacteria or something that gets out in the world, the result of this technique that creates havoc, that's going to put a total end to the science. So I'm wondering, who is the gatekeepers? Who is the organization, public or private, that is watching what's going on and talking about the potential dangers and explaining it to the public and actually stopping research that is potentially an existential threat to humanity?
It's a good question, Francis. Are there any real gatekeepers, Jennifer Doudna?
Sure. I mean, here in the United States, we have a number of regulatory agencies that oversee different types of applications of technologies in biology. So the Food and Drug Administration comes to mind. The U.S. Department of Agriculture comes to mind, and there are many others. So, you know, we have, I think, a very good infrastructure in this country for evaluating technologies and doing exactly what you're talking about, you know, really making careful evaluation of how they're being applied. But, you know, and then I should also point out, of course, that there are many non-governmental organizations that do that as well. You know, they have bioethical considerations and ethicists that take it on these issues and try to educate the public about them and educate government officials about them. I think that, you know, the challenge, though, as we talked about earlier, is how do you take that discussion global?
Well, that's another challenge as well. I'm looking at an email from a listener named Peter who says, as a former practitioner of reproductive medicine, I once questioned an embryologist about a genetic manipulation he was working on, and he replied, "You can't stop me. I'll just do it in my basement." How do you control that? Who's the gatekeeper? I mean, it does raise those kinds of questions.
It certainly does.
Yeah. Here's Diane, who has a very practical question. She says, I have a granddaughter in England who is interested in this area and is looking for a good place to study as an undergraduate. Any recommendations regarding which countries to study in or specific universities?
Well, you should certainly look at Berkeley. I have to advertise my institution. But, you know, sure. I mean, there's lots of wonderful research going on in this area globally now, really. And if she's in the UK, lots of great universities there, Cambridge and Oxford, of course, but many others. So I think she has many options to look into.
Well, we have certainly many options where we can talk about for the future of this kind of technology. But as I expected, you're getting very specific questions, like in this tweet from a listener. It says, will CRISPR help with heart conditions like tetralogy or fallot?
In principle, yes. I mean, I think if we can understand genetic basis for those kinds of diseases or traits, then we have the opportunity in principle to use them clinically. I think one of the challenges is, well, you know, I said this earlier, I think, you know, we have to understand the genes that we're altering and make sure that there aren't unintended consequences of making those changes. And frankly, another bottleneck really is a very practical one, which is how do we deliver the editing molecules to the right tissues in a patient?
Also, how do you get, just from a really kind of rudimentary standpoint, how do you get to this point where the DNA is being cut? Could give us a picture a little bit about how this actually transpires, how it takes place.
Well, if we're using this in a laboratory setting, what's done is to introduce the Cas9 protein and its associated guiding RNA into cells or tissues, where it goes into the nucleus of the cell and finds a DNA sequence that matches the sequence of the guiding RNA. So it's just like a piece of tape in a way that sticks to the DNA at a particular place.
You're actually reprogramming the protein.
That's right. And then the protein functions like a molecular pair of scissors and cuts the DNA. And then after that, repair happens, and that's when the actual gene editing occurs.
Wow. Let me get to some more of your phone calls, and let's go next to Berkeley. Bruce, you're on the air. Morning.
Good morning. Hi, Michael, and congratulations to Professor Dudna. I have a comment about use of gene drive technology to prevent disease. And if I heard comments earlier correctly, it sounded like the way to get rid of malaria was the extinction of mosquitoes. But the paper that I read late in 2015 in Science talked about using gene drive to put a malaria gene, an antibody that would prevent development of the malaria parasite within mosquitoes. So it wouldn't lead to the extinction of the mosquitoes. It just leads to the extinction of the Plasmodium parasite.
I think I read the same paper, Bruce. Yeah, and thanks for that clarification. That's true, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, I think when people have discussed gene drives, they, you know, the concern about using them would be something more extreme, like driving, you know, a species to extinction. But you're absolutely right that I think there's an exciting opportunity to use it in a less extreme fashion, where you could actually get rid of a parasite or rid of a disease-causing organism without actually affecting the ecosystem in the way that we described earlier.
Thank you for that, Bruce. Appreciate that. I'm looking at a question from a listener named Robert, who wants to know, is there an upper length limit to the palindromic trigger employed by this technique?
Well, there probably is, because it doesn't actually take over the entire genome, all of the DNA in the cell, but we don't know what puts the brakes on it yet.
Yeah. If we could triage here, what's the most fascinating question in your mind in terms of this technology that still remains looming over everything or hovering over everything?
I still don't really understand fundamentally how the searching through a genome actually works. You know, how does this bacterial protein sift through the 3 billion plus base pairs of the human genome in a cell and find one site and do it accurately? And yet we know that happens, and it happens fairly fast. So I think that's a fascinating, just fundamental question.
Well, we're getting some fascinating questions all across the board here. Nancy wants to know, has anyone at NASA started working on this technology to engineer physiological tolerances of life in space or on other planets?
Great, great question. I don't know if anyone at NASA is doing that, but I have been talking with George Church and some of his colleagues at Harvard Medical School, and I know they've been thinking also along those lines, and they actually have an academic initiative to do this.
And we're talking about malaria and mosquitoes before. A lot of that's being done in the Harvard School of Public Health.
Indeed.
That research we should mention. Let's go to more calls here. Let's go to GS next. Morning.
Yes. Thank you very much. Good morning. I was a physics major at Hazimud College in Claremont, and engineering work. We used to have a saying, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. I'm not criticizing the work that's being done. Technologies are just technologies, but, you know, it's sort of done with things and all that. So my fundamental conception, totally aside from what the possible perceptions of people in the generic public might be, that's to me, that's just an incredibly trivial issue compared to what ethical issue, yes, but at least if anybody's going to experiment with these technologies, why not at the very least build in a timeout, if you will, such that any given experiment will terminate automatically in a week or a month or a day, such that you won't be tampering with the entire web of ecology, because there are ripple effects of extinction of any species. So last point, why not do these kinds of experiments on the moon or on some asteroid or something, so that no matter what happens, it's not going to go wild on Earth. That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that statement. Jennifer Donna.
Hadn't thought about that. Research on asteroids. We'll take that under advisement.
Well, here's Dave, who writes, there is now an Indiegogo campaign for CRISPR. For a $75 donation, you get a DIY home kit to reprogram bacteria to glow in the dark. How cool is that? I ordered nine. Another caller. Let me go next to you, Keith, and thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I really appreciate the discussion of all the very important philosophical and ethical issues that are involved with this. But I am also fascinated in the technical side of it. And as you mentioned, there's still some uncertainty in as far as how these proteins are finding the DNA strands. In addition, do we know, as far as even if we can splice and replace some of this DNA, as far as how those genes are expressed and the speed with which we can create a treatment for the, I mean, there's a lot of DNA in the body. So specifically with cancer treatment, for example, how long would you expect a genetic treatment to take compared to your average radiological treatment or whatnot?
I think with respect to cancer, what's maybe most exciting there with respect to the CRISPR technology is seeing the genome editing tool come together with something called cancer immunotherapy that you may be reading about as well. It's gotten a lot of attention in the media, and rightfully so. It's a very powerful way to ensure that a patient's own immune system targets their tumor. And so the idea with genome editing would be to use it to program T cells, program the immune system to go after tumors and do that in a very, you know, I would say personalized way, a way that would be targeted to each person's unique tumor characteristics. And I think, you know, there are several company partnerships that have been announced to try to do that. And I think that's a really exciting avenue. How long will it take? You know, I can't say, because I mean, these are you know, these are clearly technologies that are, you know, kind of pushing the edge of where they are right now today. But I think, you know, within the next 5 to 10 years, they really should come to fruition for cancer, I think.
So many exciting possibilities with this technology. We were talking before about agriculture. You could theoretically, again, and this may be on the way, engineer all these staple crops that can, as I indicated, feed billions of people as the climate continues to warm. It's all within the realm.
It's certainly within the realm. I think one of the challenges there, and this is actually something we're starting to work on in the Innovative Genomics Initiative, is how do we deliver these editing molecules into different kinds of plants effectively? So that's one of the technical barriers to doing this, as well as obviously just understanding which genes do we want to change. And then, of course, there's the whole regulatory and ethical question around making modified plants. So, you know, I think these are issues that we're grappling with. But you're right, the technology enables that kind of change to be made.
Is there a lot of communication that goes on between, say, your lab and all these other labs that are burgeoning around here? I mentioned Feng Zhang of MIT, for example. There seems to be some real competition there in terms of who owns and who has the patent rights and what university and so forth. So is it scientists competing with one another, as is so often the case? And doing it by whatever means necessary and so forth? Or is there amity and civility in checking in with one another?
You know, there's both, right? I mean, I think that in my view, it's, you know, there's competition can play a healthy role. You know, it can really help drive people to do their very best work and to push fields forward. And I try to focus on those more positive sides of the competitive spirit that I think we all have. And you know, I think that in the end, we're all excited about where this is going to take us and sort of as a society, the kinds of problems and challenges that can now be addressed with what is clearly a promising technology. So I try to focus on those positive things.
And you've been saying, I think publicly, you would love to see clinical applications, treatment, help lives, help save people and really do good.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Obviously, you still got some idealism in this game.
Well, I try to stay focused on the positive.
Yeah, good for you. And as I said, I think Jennifer Doudna, our guest, has done some extraordinary research here and may indeed, as many are speculating, be a candidate for a Nobel Prize. Good luck. You've already won a Lurie, and that's a big deal. And congratulations on all the work you've done.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much for being part of the program today. Again, Jennifer Doudna is professor of chemistry and molecular and cell biology at UC Berkeley, executive director of the Innovative Genomics Initiative, and also an investigator with Howard Hughes Medical Institute. She helped develop a technology for editing genomes, and it's called CRISPR-Cas9, or simply CRISPR. That's CRISPR for short. We are here with you. This, by the way, this discussion can continue online, kqed.org/forum. And just a reminder that we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We are always appreciative of your listenership and any ideas and thoughts you might have that you can email to us, kqedforum. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Natalie Yemenijan. Our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadan. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.